Austin runs a hardware store, said Rosie, a very successful one. Judy served a delicious meal based on farmed salmon, which she assured Rosie was sustainable. I had eaten very little of the poor quality aeroplane food and enjoyed Judy's meal immensely. Isaac opened some Pinot Gris from Oregon and was generous in refilling my glass. We talked about New York and the differences between Australian and American politics. Well, said Judy, I'm so glad you could come. It makes up a little for missing the reunion. Isaac was so sorry not to be there. Not really, said Isaac. Revisiting the past is not something to do lightly. He ate the last piece of fish from his plate and looked at Rosie. You look a lot like your mother. She would have been a bit younger than you when I last saw her. Judy said, We got married the day after the graduation and moved here. Isaac had the biggest hangover at the wedding. He'd been a bad boy. She smiled. I think that's enough telling tales, Judy, said Isaac. It was all a long time ago. He stared at Rosie. Rosie stared at him. Judy picked up Rosie's plate and mine, one in each hand. I decided that this was the moment to act, with everyone distracted. I stood and picked up Isaac's plate in one hand and then Judy's. Isaac was too busy playing the staring game with Rosie to object. I took the plates to the kitchen, swabbing Isaac's fork on the way. I imagine Austin and Rosie are exhausted, said Judy when we returned to the table. You said you're a hardware man, Austin. Isaac stood up. Can you spare 5 minutes to look at a tap for me? It's probably a job for a plumber, but maybe it's just a washer. He means faucet, said Judy, presumably forgetting we came from the same country as Isaac. Isaac and I went down the stairs to the basement. I was confident I could help with the tap problem. My school holidays had been spent providing advice of exactly this kind. But as we reached the bottom of the stairs, the lights went out. I wasn't sure what had happened. A power failure? You okay, Don? Said Isaac, sounding concerned. I'm okay, I said. What happened? What happened is that you answered to Don, Austin. We stood there in the dark. I doubted that there were social conventions for dealing with interrogation by a psychiatrist in a dark cellar. How did you know? I asked. Two unsolicited communications from the same university in a month. An internet search. You make good dancing partners. More silence and darkness. I know the answer to your question, but I made a promise that I would not reveal it. If I thought it was a matter of life or death, or a serious mental health issue, I would reconsider, but I see no reason to break the promise, which was made because the people involved had thought hard about what would be right. You came a long way for my DNA, and I'm guessing you got it when you cleared the plates. You might want to think beyond your girlfriend's wishes before you proceed. He turned on the light. Something bothered me as we walked up the stairs. At the top, I stopped. If you knew what I wanted, why did you let us come to your house? Good question, he said. Since you asked the question, I'm sure you can work out the answer. I wanted to see Rosie. Chapter 24. Thanks to the carefully timed use of sleeping pills, I woke without any feeling of disorientation at 7:06 a.m. Rosie had fallen asleep in the train on the way to the hotel. I had decided not to tell her immediately about the basement encounter, nor mention what I had observed on the sideboard. It was a large photo of Judy and Isaac's wedding. Standing beside Isaac, dressed in the formal clothes required of a best man, was Jeffrey Case, who had only 370 days to live. He was smiling. I was still processing the implications myself, and Rosie would probably have an emotional response that could spoil the New York experience. She was impressed that I had collected the DNA, and even more impressed that I had acted so unobtrusively when I picked up the dishes to assist. You're in danger of learning some social skills. The hotel was perfectly comfortable. After we checked in, Rosie said that she'd been worried that I would expect her to share a room in exchange for paying for her trip to New York. Like a prostitute. I was highly insulted. She seemed pleased with my reaction. I had an excellent workout at the hotel gym and returned to find the message light blinking. Rosie. Where were you? She said. In the gym. Exercise is critical in reducing the effects of jet lag, also sunlight. I've planned to walk 29 blocks in sunlight. Aren't you forgetting something? Today is my day, and tomorrow I own you until midnight Monday. Now get your butt down here. I'm hanging out for breakfast. In my gym clothes. No, Don, not in your gym clothes. Shower, dress. You have 10 minutes. I always have my breakfast before I shower. How old are you? Said Rosie aggressively. She didn't wait for the answer. You're like an old man. I always have my breakfast before I shower. Don't sit in my chair. That's where I sit. Do not fuck with me, Don Tillman. She said the last words quite slowly. I decided it was best not to fuck with her. By midnight tomorrow, it would be over. In the interim, I would adopt the dentist mindset. It seemed I was in for a root canal filling. I arrived downstairs and Rosie was immediately critical. How long have you had that shirt? 14 years, I said. It dries very quickly, perfect for travelling. In fact, it was a specialised walking shirt, though fabric technology had progressed significantly since it was made. Good, said Rosie. It doesn't owe you anything. Upstairs, other shirt. It's wet. I mean Claudia's shirt, and the jeans while you're at it. I'm not walking around New York with a bum. When I came down for the second attempt at breakfast, Rosie smiled. You know, you're not such a bad-looking guy underneath. She stopped and looked at me. Don, you're not enjoying this, are you? You'd rather be by yourself in the museum, right? She was extremely perceptive. I get that. But you've done all these things for me. You've brought me to New York, and by the way, I haven't finished spending your money yet. So I want to do something for you. I could have argued that her wanting to do something for me meant she was ultimately acting in her own interests, but it might provoke more of the don't fuck with me behavior. You're in a different place. You're in different clothes. When the medieval pilgrims used to arrive at Santiago after walking hundreds of kilometers, they burned their clothes to symbolize that they changed. I'm not asking you to burn your clothes yet. Put them on again on Tuesday. Just be open to something different. Let me show you my world for a couple of days, starting with breakfast. We're in the city with the best breakfast in the world. She must have seen that I was resisting. Hey, you schedule your time so you don't waste it, right? Correct. So you've committed to 2 days with me. If you shut yourself down, you're wasting 2 days of your life that someone is trying to make exciting and productive and fun for you. I'm going to... She stopped. I left the guidebook in my room. When I come down, we're going to breakfast. She turned and walked to the elevators. I was disturbed by Rosie's logic. I'd always justified my schedule in terms of efficiency. But was my allegiance to efficiency, or was it to the schedule itself? Was I really like my father, who had insisted on sitting in the same chair every night? I'd never mentioned this to Rosie. I had my own special chair, too. There was another argument that she'd not presented because she could not have known it. In the last 8 weeks, I'd experienced two of the three best times of my adult life, assuming all visits to the Museum of Natural History were treated as one event. They'd both been with Rosie. Was there a correlation? It was critical to find out. By the time Rosie came back, I'd performed a brain reboot, an exercise requiring a considerable effort of will. But I was now configured for adaptability. So, she said. So, how do we find the world's best breakfast? We found the world's best breakfast around the corner. It may have been the unhealthiest breakfast I had ever eaten, but I would not put on significant weight nor lose fitness, brain acuity, or martial arts skills if I neglected them for 2 days. This was the mode my brain was now operating in. I can't believe you ate all that, said Rosie. It tasted so good. No lunch, late dinner, she said. We can eat any time. Our server approached the table. Rosie indicated the empty coffee cups. They were great. I think we would both manage another. Huh? Said the server. It was obvious that she hadn't understood Rosie. It was also obvious that Rosie had very poor taste in coffee, or she had done as I had and ignored the label coffee, and was enjoying it as an entirely new beverage. The technique was working brilliantly. One regular coffee with cream and one regular coffee without cream. Please, I said. Sure. This was a town where people talk straight. My kind of town. I was enjoying speaking American. Cream instead of milk. Elevator instead of lift. Check instead of bill. I had memorized a list of differences between American and Australian usage prior to my first trip to the US and had been surprised at how quickly my brain was able to switch into using them automatically. We walked uptown. Rosie was looking at a guidebook called Not for Tourists, which seemed a very poor choice. Where are we going? I asked. We're not going anywhere. We're there. We were outside a clothing store. Rosie asked if it was okay to go inside. You don't have to ask, I said. You're in control. I do about shops. It's a girl's thing. I was going to say, I suppose you've been on Fifth Avenue before, but I don't suppose anything with you. The situation was symmetrical. I knew not to suppose anything about Rosie, or I would have been surprised by her describing herself as a girl, a term that I understood to be unacceptable to feminists when referring to adult women. Rosie was becoming remarkably perceptive about me. I'd never been beyond the conference centres and the museum, but with my new mind configuration, I was finding everything fascinating. A whole shop for cigars, the prices of jewellery, the Flatiron Building, the Sex Museum. Rosie looked at the last of these and chose not to go in. This was probably a good decision. It might be fascinating, but the risk of a faux pas would be very high. Do you want to buy anything? Said Rosie. No. A few minutes later, a thought occurred to me. Is there somewhere that sells men's shirts? Rosie laughed. On Fifth Avenue, New York City, maybe we'll get lucky. I detected sarcasm, but in a friendly way. We found a new shirt of the same genre as the Claudia shirt at a huge store called Bloomingdale's, which was not, in fact, on Fifth Avenue. We could not choose between two candidate shirts and bought both. My wardrobe would be overflowing. We arrived at Central Park. We're skipping lunch, but I could handle an ice cream, said Rosie. There was a vendor in the park, and he was serving both cones and prefabricated confections. I was filled with an irrational sense of dread. I identified it immediately, but I had to know. Is the flavour important? Something with peanuts. We're in the States. All ice creams taste the same. Bullshit. I explained about taste buds. Want to bet, said Rosie. If I can tell the difference between peanut and vanilla, two tickets to Spider-Man. On Broadway, tonight. The textures will be different because of the peanuts. Any two, your choice. I ordered an apricot and a mango. Close your eyes, I said. It wasn't really necessary. The colours were almost identical, but I didn't want her to see me tossing a coin to decide which one to show her. I was concerned that with her psychological skills, she might guess my sequence. I tossed the coin and gave her an ice cream. Mango, guessed Rosie correctly. Toss, heads again. Mango again. She picked the mango correctly three times, then the apricot again. The chances of her achieving this result randomly were 1 in 32. I could be 97% confident that she was able to differentiate. Incredible. So, Spider-Man tonight? No, you got one wrong. Rosie looked at me very carefully, then burst out laughing. You're bullshitting me, aren't you? I can't believe it. You're making jokes. She gave me an ice cream. Since you don't care, you can have the apricot. I looked at it. What to say? She'd been licking it. Once again, she read my mind. How are you going to kiss a girl if you won't share her ice cream? For several minutes, I was suffused with an irrational feeling of enormous pleasure, basking in the success of my joke, and passing the sentence about the kiss. Kiss a girl. Share her ice cream. It was third person, but surely not unrelated to the girl who was sharing her ice cream right now with Don Tillman in his new shirt and jeans as we walked among the trees in Central Park, New York City, on a sunny Sunday afternoon. I needed the 114 minutes of time out back at the hotel, although I'd enjoyed the day immensely. Shower, email, relaxation exercises combined with stretches. I emailed Jean, copying in Claudia, with a summary of our activities. Rosie was 3 minutes late for our 7 p.m. foyer meeting. I was about to call her room when she arrived wearing clothes purchased that day. White jeans and a blue T-shirt thing, and the jacket she had worn the previous evening. I remembered a jeanism, something I'd heard him say to Claudia. "You're looking very elegant," I said. It was a risky statement, but her reaction appeared to be positive. She did look very elegant. We had cocktails at a bar with the world's longest cocktail list, including many I did not know, and we saw Spider-Man. Afterwards, Rosie felt the story was a bit predictable, but I was overwhelmed by everything, in a hugely positive way. I'd not been to the theatre since I was a child. I could have ignored the story and focused entirely on the mechanics of the flying. It was just incredible. We caught the subway back to the Lower East Side. I was hungry but did not want to break the rules by suggesting that we eat. But Rosie had this plan too. A 10 p.m. booking at a restaurant called Momofuku Ko. We were on Rosie time again. "This is my present to you for bringing me here," she said. We sat at a counter for 12 where we could watch the chefs at work. There were few of the annoying formalities that make restaurants so stressful. "Any preferences, allergies, dislikes?" asked the chef. "I'm vegetarian, but I eat sustainable seafood," said Rosie. "He eats everything, and I mean everything. I lost count of the courses. I had sweetbreads and foie gras, first time, and sea urchin roe. We drank a bottle of rosé champagne. I talked to the chefs and they told me what they were doing. I ate the best food I'd ever eaten, and I did not need to wear a jacket in order to eat. In fact, the man sitting beside me was wearing a costume that would have been extreme at the Marquis of Queensbury, including multiple facial piercings. He heard me speaking to the chef and asked me where I was from. I told him, 'How are you finding New York?' I told him I was finding it highly interesting and explained how we had spent our day. But I was conscious that, under the stress of talking to a stranger, my manner had changed, or, to be more precise, reverted to my usual style. During the day with Rosie, I'd felt relaxed and had spoken and acted differently. And this continued in my conversation with the chef, which was essentially a professional exchange of information. But informal social interaction with another person had triggered my regular behavior. And my regular behavior and speaking style is, I am well aware, considered odd by others. The man with the piercings must have noticed. 'You know what I like about New York?' he said. 'There are so many weird people that nobody takes any notice. We all just fit right in.'" "How was it?" said Rosie as we walked back to the hotel. "The best day of my adult life," I said. Rosie seemed so happy with my response that I decided not to finish the sentence, excluding the Museum of Natural History. "Sleep in," she said. 9:30 here, and we'll do the brunch thing again. Okay?" It would have been totally irrational to argue. Chapter 25. Did I cause any embarrassment? Rosie had been concerned that I might make inappropriate comments during our tour of the World Trade Center site. Our guide, a former firefighter named Frank, who had lost many of his colleagues in the attack, was incredibly interesting, and I asked a number of technical questions that he answered intelligently and, it seemed to me, enthusiastically. "You may have changed the tone a bit," she said. "You sort of moved the attention away from the emotional impact." So, I had reduced the sadness. Good. Monday was allocated to visiting popular tourist sites. We had breakfast at Katz's Deli, where a scene for a film called When Harry Met Sally was shot. We went to the top of the Empire State Building, famous as a location for an affair to remember. We visited MoMA and the Met, which were excellent. We were back at the hotel early, 4:32 p.m.
"Back here at 6:30, said Rosie.
"What are we having for dinner?"
"Hot dogs. We're going to the baseball."
I never watch sport. Ever. The reasons are obvious, or should be to anyone who values their time. But my reconfigured mind, sustained by huge doses of positive reinforcement, accepted the proposition. I spent the next 118 minutes on the internet, learning about the rules and the players. On the subway, Rosie had some news for me. Before she left Melbourne, she had sent an email to Mary Keneally, a researcher working in her field at Columbia University.
She'd just received a reply and Mary could see her tomorrow. But she wouldn't be able to make it to the Museum of Natural History. She could come Wednesday, but would I be okay by myself tomorrow? Of course I would. At Yankee Stadium, we got beer and hot dogs. A man in a cap, estimated age 35, estimated BMI 40, i.e. dangerously fat, sat beside me. He had 3 hot dogs. The source of the obesity was obvious. The game started, and I had to explain to Rosie what was happening. It was fascinating to see how the rules worked in a real game. Every time there was an event on the field, Fat Baseball Fan would make an annotation in his book. There were runners on 2nd and 3rd when Curtis Granderson came to the plate, and Fat Baseball Fan spoke to me. If he bats in, both of these guys will be heading the league on RBI. What are the odds? I didn't know what the odds were. All I could tell him was that they were somewhere between 9.9 and 27.2%, based on the batting average and percentage of home runs listed in the profile I'd read. I'd not had time to memorize the statistics for doubles and triples. A Fat Baseball Fan, nevertheless, seemed impressed, and we began a very interesting conversation. He showed me how to mark the program with symbols to represent the various events, and how the more sophisticated statistics worked. I had no idea sport could be so intellectually stimulating. Rosie got more beer and hot dogs, and Fat Baseball Fan started to tell me about Joe DiMaggio's streak in 1941, which he claimed was a uniquely odds-defying achievement. I was doubtful, and the conversation was just getting interesting when the game ended, so he suggested we take the subway to a bar in Midtown. As Rosie was in charge of the schedule, I asked for her opinion, and she agreed. The bar was noisy, and there was more baseball playing on a large television screen. Some other men, who did not appear to have previously met Fat Baseball Fan, joined our discussion. We drank a lot of beer and talked about baseball statistics. Rosie sat on a stool with her drink and observed. It was late when Fat Baseball Fan, whose actual name was Dave, said he had to go home. We exchanged email addresses, and I considered that I had made a new friend. Walking back to the hotel, I realized that I had behaved in stereotypical male fashion, drinking beer in a bar, watching television, and talking about sport. It is generally known that women have a negative attitude to such behavior. I asked Rosie if I had offended her. Not at all. I had fun watching you being a guy, fitting in. I told her that this was a highly unusual response from a feminist, but that it would make her a very attractive partner to conventional men, if I was interested in conventional men. It seemed a good opportunity to ask a question about Rosie's personal life. Do you have a boyfriend? I hoped I had used an appropriate term. Sure. I just haven't unpacked him from my suitcase, she said, obviously making a joke. I laughed, then pointed out that she hadn't actually answered my question. Don, she said, don't you think that if I had a boyfriend, you might have heard about him by now? It seemed to me entirely possible that I would not have heard about him. I had asked Rosie very few personal questions outside the Father Project. I did not know any of her friends, except perhaps Stefan, who I had concluded was not her boyfriend. Of course, it would have been traditional to bring any partner to the faculty ball and not to offer me sex afterwards, but not everyone was bound by such conventions. Jean was the perfect example. It seemed entirely possible that Rosie had a boyfriend who did not like dancing or socializing with academics, was out of town at the time, or was in an open relationship with her. She had no reason to tell me. In my own life, I had rarely mentioned Daphne or my sister to Jean and Claudia or vice versa. They belonged to different parts of my life. I explained this to Rosie. Short answer? No, she said. We walked a bit further. Long answer? You asked what I meant about being fucked up by my father. Psychology 101. Our first relationship with a male is with our fathers. It affects how we relate to men forever, so lucky me, I get a choice of two. Phil, who's fucked in the head, or my real father, who walked away from me and my mother. And I get this choice when I'm 12 years old and Phil sits me down and has this, I wish your mother could be here to tell you, talk with me. You know, just the standard stuff your dad tells you at 12. I'm not your dad. Your mum, who died before you could know her properly, isn't the perfect person you thought she was, and you're only here because of your mother being easy, and I wish you weren't so I could go off and have a life.
He said that to you?
Not in those words, but that's what he meant. I thought it highly unlikely that a 12-year-old, even a female future psychology student, could correctly deduce an adult male's unspoken thoughts. Sometimes it is better to be aware of one's incompetence in these matters, as I am, than to have a false sense of expertise. So I don't trust men. I don't believe they're what they say they are. I'm afraid they're going to let me down. That's my summary from 7 years of studying psychology. This seemed a very poor result for 7 years of effort, but I assumed she was omitting the more general knowledge provided by the course.
You want to meet tomorrow evening? Said Rosie. We can do whatever you want to do.
I had been thinking about my plans for the next day. I know someone at Columbia, I said. Maybe we could go there together.
What about the museum?
I've already compressed 4 visits into 2. I can compress 2 into 1. There was no logic in this, but I had drunk a lot of beer, and I just felt like going to Columbia. Go with the flow.
See you at 8. And don't be late, said Rosie.
Then she kissed me. It was not a passionate kiss, it was on the cheek, but it was disturbing. Neither positive nor negative, just disturbing. I emailed David Borenstein at Columbia, then Skyped Claudia and told her about the day, omitting the kiss.
Sounds like she's made a big effort, said Claudia.
This was obviously true. Rosie had managed to select activities that I would normally have avoided, but enjoyed immensely.
And you're giving her the guided tour of the Museum of Natural History on Wednesday?
No. I'm going to look at the crustaceans and the Antarctic flora and fauna.
Try again, said Claudia.
Chapter 26. We took the subway to Columbia. David Borenstein had not replied to my email. I did not mention this to Rosie, who invited me to a meeting, if it did not clash with mine.
I'll say you're a fellow researcher, she said. I'd like you to see what I do when I'm not mixing drinks.
Mary Keneally was an associate professor of psychiatry in the medical faculty. I'd never asked Rosie the topic of her PhD. It turned out to be environmental risks for early onset bipolar disorder, a serious scientific topic. Rosie's approach appeared sound and well considered. She and Mary talked for 53 minutes, and then we all went for coffee.
At heart, Mary said to Rosie, you're a psychiatrist rather than a psychologist. You've never thought of transferring to medicine?
I came from a medical family, said Rosie. I sort of rebelled.
Well, when you finish rebelling, we've got a great MD program here.
Right, said Rosie. Me at Columbia.
Why not?
In fact, since you've come all this way, she made a quick phone call and smiled. Come and meet the dean. As we walked back to the medical building, Rosie said to me, I hope you're suitably impressed. We arrived at the dean's office, and he stepped out to meet us.
Don, he said, I just got your email. I haven't had a chance to reply.
He turned to Rosie. I'm David Borenstein. And you're with Don? We all had lunch at the faculty club. David told Rosie that he had supported my O-1 visa application.
I didn't lie, he said. Anytime Don feels like joining the main game, there's a job for him here.
Coal oven pizza is supposedly environmentally unsound, but I treat statements of this kind with great suspicion. They're frequently emotionally based rather than scientific and ignore full life cycle costs. Electricity good, coal bad, but where does the electricity come from? Our pizza at Arturo's was excellent. World's best pizza. I was interested in one of the statements Rosie had made at Columbia.
I thought you admired your mother. Why wouldn't you want to be a doctor?
It wasn't my mother. My father's a doctor too, remember? That's what we're here for. She poured the rest of the red wine into her glass.
I thought about it. I did the GAMSAT, like I told Peter Endicott. And I did get 74. Suck on that.
Despite the aggressive words, her expression remained friendly.
I thought that doing medicine would be a sign of some sort of obsession with my real father, like I was following him rather than Phil.
Even I could see that was a bit fucked up. Jean frequently states that psychologists are incompetent at understanding themselves. Rosie seemed to have provided good evidence for that proposition. Why avoid something that she would enjoy and be good at? And surely 3 years of undergraduate education in psychology, plus several years of postgraduate research, should have provided a more precise classification of her behavioural, personality and emotional problems than fucked up. Naturally, I did not share these thoughts. We were first in line when the museum opened at 10:30 a.m. I had planned the visit according to the history of the universe, the planet and life. 13 billion years of history in 6 hours. At noon, Rosie suggested we delete lunch from the schedule to allow more time with the exhibits. Later, she stopped at the reconstruction of the famous Laetoli footprints made by hominids approximately 3.6 million years ago. I read an article about this. It was a mother and child holding hands, right? It was a romantic interpretation, but not impossible. Have you ever thought of having children, Don? Yes, I said, forgetting to deflect this personal question. But it seems both unlikely and inadvisable. Why? Well, unlikely because I've lost confidence in the wife project, and inadvisable because I would be an unsuitable father. Why? Because I'd be an embarrassment to my children. Rosie laughed. I thought this was very insensitive, but she explained, all parents are an embarrassment to their kids. Including Phil? She laughed again. Especially Phil. At 4:28 p.m. we had finished the primates.
Oh no, we're done? Said Rosie. Is there something else we can see?
We have two more things to see, I said. You may find them dull. I took her to the room of balls, spheres of different sizes showing the scale of the universe. The display is not dramatic, but the information is. Non-scientists, non-physical scientists, frequently have no idea of scale, how small we are compared to the size of the universe, how big compared to the size of a neutrino. I did my best to make it interesting. Then we went up in the elevator and joined the Heilbrunn Cosmic Pathway, a 110-meter spiral ramp representing a timeline from the Big Bang to the present. It is just pictures and photos and occasional rocks and fossils on the wall, and I didn't even need to look at them because I know the story, which I related as accurately and dramatically as I could, putting all that we had seen during the day into context. As we walked down and around until we reached the ground level and the tiny vertical hairline representing all of recorded human history. It was almost closing time now, and we were the only people standing there. On other occasions, I've listened to people's reactions as they reach the end. Makes you feel a bit unimportant, doesn't it? They say. I suppose that is one way of looking at it. How the age of the universe somehow diminishes our lives or the events of history or Joe DiMaggio's streak. But Rosie's response was a verbal version of mine. Wow, she said, very quietly, looking back at the vastness of it all. Then, in this vanishingly small moment in the history of the universe, she took my hand and held it all the way to the subway. Chapter 27. We had one critical task to perform before leaving New York the following morning. Max Freiberg, the cosmetic surgeon and potential biological father of Rosie, who was booked solid, had agreed to see us for 15 minutes at 6:45 p.m. Rosie had told his secretary she was writing a series of articles for a publication about successful alumni of the university. I was carrying Rosie's camera and would be identified as a photographer. Getting the appointment had been difficult enough, but it had become apparent that collecting the DNA would be far more difficult in a working environment than in a social or domestic location. I had set my brain the task of solving the problem before we departed for New York, and had expected it to have found a solution through background processing, but it had apparently been too occupied with other matters. The best I could think of was a spiked ring that would draw blood when we shook hands, but Rosie considered this socially infeasible. She suggested clipping a hair, either surreptitiously or after identifying it as a stray that would mar the photo. Surely a cosmetic surgeon would care about his appearance. Unfortunately, a clipped hair was unlikely to yield an adequate sample. It needed to be plucked to obtain a follicle. Rosie packed a pair of tweezers.
For once, I hoped I might have to spend 15 minutes in a smoke-filled room. A cigarette butt would solve our problem. We would have to be alert to opportunities.
Dr. Freiberg's rooms were in an older-style building on the Upper West Side. Rosie pushed the buzzer, and a security guard appeared and took us up to a waiting area, where the walls were totally covered with framed certificates and letters from patients praising Dr. Freiberg's work. Dr. Freiberg's secretary, a very thin woman, BMI estimate 16, of about 55, with disproportionately thick lips, led us into his office. More certificates. Freiberg himself had a major fault. He was completely bald. The hair-plucking approach would not be viable. Nor was there any evidence that he was a smoker. Rosie conducted the interview very impressively. Freiberg described some procedures that seemed to have minimal clinical justification and talked about their importance to self-esteem. It was fortunate that I'd been allocated the silent role, as I would have been strongly tempted to argue. I was also struggling to focus. My mind was still processing the hand-holding incident.
"I'm sorry," said Rosie, "but could I bother you for something to drink?"
"Of course, the coffee swab solution."
"Sure," said Freiberg. "Tea, coffee?"
"Coffee would be great," said Rosie. "Just black. Will you have one yourself?"
"I'm good. Let's keep going."
He pushed a button on his intercom.
"Rachel, one black coffee."
"You should have a coffee," I said to him.
"Never touch it," said Freiberg.
"Unless you have a genetic intolerance of caffeine, there are no proven harmful effects. On the contrary..."
"What magazine is this for again?"
The question was straightforward and totally predictable. We had agreed the name of the fictitious university publication in advance, and Rosie had already used it in her introduction. But my brain malfunctioned. Rosie and I spoke simultaneously. Rosie said, "Faces of change." I said, "Hands of change." It was a minor inconsistency that any rational person would have interpreted as a simple, innocent error, which in fact it was. But Freiberg's expression indicated disbelief, and he immediately scribbled on a notepad. When Rachel brought the coffee, he gave her the note. I diagnosed paranoia and started to think about escape plans. "I need to use the bathroom," I said. I planned to phone Freiberg from the bathroom so Rosie could escape while he took the call. I walked towards the exit, but Freiberg blocked my path.
"Use my private one," he said. "I insist."
He led me through the back of his office, past Rachel, to a door marked private and left me there. There was no way to exit without returning the way we had come. I took out my phone, called 411, directory assistance, and they connected me to Rachel. I could hear the phone ring and Rachel answer. I kept my voice low.
"I need to speak to Dr. Freiberg," I said. "It's an emergency."
I explained that my wife was a patient of Dr. Freiberg and that her lips had exploded. I hung up and texted Rosie, "Exit now." The bathroom was in need of Eva's services. I managed to open the window, which had obviously not been used for a long time. We were four floors up, but there seemed to be plenty of handholds on the wall. I eased myself through the window and started climbing down, slowly, focusing on the task, hoping Rosie had escaped successfully. It had been a long time since I had practiced rock climbing, and the descent was not as simple as it first seemed. The wall was slippery from rain earlier in the day, and my running shoes were not ideal for the task. At one point I slipped and only just managed to grasp a rough brick. I heard shouts from below. When I finally reached the ground, I discovered that a small crowd had formed. Rosie was among them. She flung her arms around me.
"Oh my God, Don, you could have killed yourself. It didn't matter that much."
The risk was minor. It was just important to ignore the height issue. We headed for the subway. Rosie was quite agitated. Freiberg had thought that she was some sort of private investigator, working on behalf of a dissatisfied patient. He was trying to have the security personnel detain her. Whether his position was legally defensible or not, we would have been in a difficult position.
"I'm going to get changed," said Rosie. "Our last night in New York City. What do you want to do?"
My original schedule specified a steakhouse, but now that we are in the pattern of eating together, I would need to select a restaurant suitable for a sustainable seafood-eating vegetarian.
"We'll work it out," she said. "Lots of options."
It took me 3 minutes to change my shirt.
I waited downstairs for Rosie for another 6. Finally, I went up to her room and I knocked. There was a long wait. Then I heard her voice.
How long do you think it takes to have a shower?
3 minutes, 20 seconds, I said, unless I wash my hair, in which case it takes an extra 1 minute and 12 seconds. The additional time was due primarily to the requirement that the conditioner remain in place for 60 seconds.
Hold on.
Rosie opened the door wearing only a towel. Her hair was wet, and she looked extremely attractive. I forgot to keep my eyes directed towards her face. Hey, she said, no pendant. She was right. I couldn't use the pendant excuse. But she didn't give me a lecture on inappropriate behavior. Instead, she smiled and stepped towards me. I wasn't sure if she was going to take another step or if I should. In the end, neither of us did. It was an awkward moment, but I suspected we'd both contributed to the problem.
You should have brought the ring, said Rosie.
For a moment, my brain interpreted ring as wedding ring and began constructing a completely incorrect scenario. Then I realized that she was referring to the spiked ring I'd proposed as a means of obtaining Freiberg's blood. To come all this way and not get a sample. Fortunately, we have one.
You got a sample? How?
His bathroom. What a slob. He should get his prostate checked. The flort stop, said Rosie. Too much information. But nice work. Very poor hygiene, I told her. For a surgeon. A pseudo-surgeon. Incredible waste of surgical skill, inserting synthetic materials purely to alter appearance. Wait till you're 55 and your partner's 45 and see if you say the same thing. You're supposed to be a feminist, I said, though I was beginning to doubt it.
It doesn't mean I want to be unattractive.
Your appearance should be irrelevant to your partner's assessment of you.
Life is full of should-bes, said Rosie.
You're the geneticist. Everyone notices how people look, even you.
True, but I don't allow it to affect my evaluation of them.
I was on dangerous territory. The issue of Rosie's attractiveness had got me into serious trouble on the night of the faculty ball. The statement was consistent with my beliefs about judging people and with how I would wish to be judged myself. But I had never had to apply these beliefs to someone standing opposite me in a hotel bedroom wearing only a towel. It dawned on me that I had not told the full truth. Ignoring the testosterone factor, I added.
Is there a compliment buried in there somewhere?
The conversation was getting complicated. I tried to clarify my position. It would be unreasonable to give you credit for being incredibly beautiful. What I did next was undoubtedly a result of my thoughts being scrambled by a sequence of extraordinary and traumatic incidents in the preceding few hours. The hand-holding, the escape from the cosmetic surgery and the extreme impact of the world's most beautiful woman standing naked under a towel in front of me. Jean should also take some blame for suggesting that earlobe size was a predictor of sexual attraction. Since I had never been so sexually attracted to a woman before, I was suddenly compelled to examine her ears. In a moment that was, in retrospect, similar to a critical incident in Albert Camus' The Outsider, I reached out and brushed her hair aside. But in this case, amazingly, the response was different from that documented in the novel we had studied in high school. Rosie put her arms around me and kissed me. I think it is likely that my brain is wired in a non-standard configuration, but my ancestors would not have succeeded in breeding without understanding and responding to basic sexual signals. That aptitude was hardwired in. I kissed Rosie back. She responded. We pulled apart for a moment. It was obvious that dinner would be delayed. Rosie studied me and said,
"You know, if you change your glasses and your haircut, you could be Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird."
"Is that good?" I assumed, given the circumstances that it was, but wanted to hear her confirm it. He was only the sexiest man that ever lived. We looked at each other some more, and I moved to kiss her again. She stopped me.
"Don, this is New York. It's like a holiday. I don't want you to assume it means anything more."
"What happens in New York stays in New York, right?" It was a line Jean had taught me for conference use. I'd never needed to employ it before. It felt a little odd, but appropriate for the circumstances. It was obviously important that we both agreed there was no emotional continuation. Although I did not have a wife at home like Jean, I had a concept of a wife that was very different from Rosie, who would presumably step out on the balcony for a cigarette after sex. Oddly, the prospect didn't repel me as much as it should have. "I've got to get something from my room," I said.
"Good thinking. Don't take too long."
My room was only 11 floors above Rosie's, so I walked up the stairs. Back in my room, I showered, then thumbed through the book Jean had given me. He'd been right, after all. Incredible. I descended the stairs to Rosie's room. 43 minutes had passed. I knocked on the door and Rosie answered, now wearing a sleeping costume that was, in fact, more revealing than the towel. She was holding two glasses of champagne.
"Sorry, it's gone a bit flat."
I looked around the room. The bed cover was turned down. The curtains were closed. There was just one bedside lamp on. I gave her Jean's book. "Since this is our first and probably only time, and you are doubtless more experienced, I recommend that you select the position." Rosie thumbed through the book, then started again. She stopped at the first page where Jean had written his symbol. "Jean gave you this. It was a present for the trip." I tried to read Rosie's expression and guessed anger, but that disappeared and she said in a non-angry tone, "Don, I'm sorry I can't do this. I'm really sorry." "Did I say something wrong?" "No, it's me. I'm really sorry." "You changed your mind while I was gone?" "Yeah," said Rosie. "That's what happened. I'm sorry." "Are you sure I didn't do something wrong?" Rosie was my friend, and the risk to our friendship was now at the forefront of my mind. The sex issue had evaporated. "No, no, it's me," she said. "You were incredibly considerate." It was a compliment I was unaccustomed to receiving. A very satisfying compliment. The night had not been a total disaster. I could not sleep. I had not eaten, and it was only 8:55 p.m. Claudia and Jean would be at work now, back in Melbourne, and I did not feel like talking to either of them. I considered it inadvisable to contact Rosie again, so I rang my remaining friend. Dave had eaten already, but we walked to a pizza restaurant and he ate a second dinner. Then we went to a bar and watched baseball and talked about women. I do not recall much of what either of us said, but I suspect that little of it would have been useful in making rational plans for the future. Chapter 28. My mind had gone blank. That is a standard phrase and an exaggeration of the situation. My brainstem continued to function, my heart still beat, I did not forget to breathe. I was able to pack my bag, consume breakfast in my room, navigate to JFK, negotiate check-in and board the plane to Los Angeles. I managed to communicate with Rosie to the extent that it was necessary to coordinate these activities. But reflective functioning was suspended. The reason was obvious: emotional overload. My normally well-managed emotions had been allowed out in New York, on the advice of Claudia, a qualified clinical psychologist, and had been dangerously overstimulated. Now they were running amok in my brain, crippling my ability to think, and I needed all my thinking ability to analyze the problem. Rosie had the window seat and I was by the aisle. I followed the pre-takeoff safety procedures, for once not dwelling on their unjustified assumptions and irrational priorities. In the event of impending disaster, we would all have something to do. I was in the opposite position, incapacitated. Rosie put her hand on my arm.
"How are you feeling, Don?"
I tried to focus on analyzing one aspect of the experience and the corresponding emotional reaction. I knew where to start. Logically, I did not need to go back to my room to get Jean's book. Showing a book to Rosie was not part of the original scenario I had planned back in Melbourne when I prepared for a sexual encounter. I may be socially inept, but with the kiss underway and Rosie wearing only a towel, there should have been no difficulties in proceeding. My knowledge of positions was a bonus, but probably irrelevant the first time. So why did my instincts drive me to a course of action that ultimately sabotaged the opportunity? The first level answer was obvious.
They were telling me not to proceed, but why? I identified three possibilities. One, I was afraid that I would fail to perform sexually. It did not take long to dismiss this possibility. I might well have been less competent than a more experienced person and could even have been rendered impotent by fear, though I considered this unlikely. But I was accustomed to being embarrassed, even in front of Rosie. The sexual drive was much stronger than any requirement to protect my image. Two. No condom. I realized, on reflection, that Rosie had probably assumed that I had left her room to collect or purchase a condom. Obviously, I should have obtained one in line with all recommendations on safe sex, and presumably the concierge would have some for emergencies, along with spare toothbrushes and razors. The fact that I did not do so was further evidence that subconsciously I did not expect to proceed. Jean had once told me a story about racing around Cairo in a taxi trying to find a condom vendor. My motivation had clearly not been as strong. Three, I could not deal with the emotional consequences. The third possibility only entered my mind after I eliminated the first and second. I immediately knew, instinctively, that it was the correct one. My brain was already emotionally overloaded. It was not the death-defying climb from the surgeon's window, or the memory of being interrogated in a dark cellar by a bearded psychiatrist who would stop at nothing to protect his secret. It was not even the experience of holding Rosie's hand from the museum to the subway, although that was a contributor. It was the total experience of hanging out with Rosie in New York. My instincts were telling me that if I added any more to this experience, if I added the literally mind-blowing experience of having sex with her, my emotions would take over my brain, and they would drive me towards a relationship with Rosie. That would be a disaster for two reasons. The first was that she was totally unsuitable in the longer term. The second was that she had made it clear that such a relationship would not extend beyond our time in New York. These reasons were completely contradictory, mutually exclusive, and based on entirely different premises. I had no idea which one was correct. We were in the final stages of our descent into LAX. I turned to Rosie. It had been several hours since she asked her question, and I had now given it considerable thought. How was I feeling? Confused, I said to her. I expected her to have forgotten the question, but perhaps the answer made sense in any case. Welcome to the real world. I managed to stay awake for the first 6 hours of the 15-hour flight home from L.A. in order to reset my internal clock, but it was difficult. Rosie had slept for a few hours, then watched a movie. I looked over and saw that she was crying. She removed her headphones and wiped her eyes. "You're crying," I said. "Is there a problem?" "Sprung," said Rosie. "It's just a sad story. Bridges of Madison County. I presume you don't cry at movies." "Correct." I realized that this might be viewed as a negative, so added in defense, "It seems to be a predominantly female behavior." "Thanks for that." Rosie went quiet again, but seemed to have recovered from the sadness that the movie had stimulated. "Tell me," she said, "do you feel anything when you watch a movie? You've seen Casablanca?" I was familiar with this question. Jean and Claudia had asked it after we watched a DVD together. So my answer was the result of reflection. "I've seen several romantic movies. The answer is no. Unlike Jean and Claudia, and apparently the majority of the human race, I'm not emotionally affected by love stories. I don't appear to be wired for that response." I visited Claudia and Jean for dinner on the Sunday night. I was feeling unusually jet-lagged, and as a result had some difficulty in providing a coherent account of the trip. I tried to talk about my meeting with David Borenstein at Columbia, what I saw at the museums, and the meal at Momofuku Ko, but they were obsessed with grilling me about my interactions with Rosie. I could not reasonably be expected to remember every detail, and obviously I could not talk about the father project activities. Claudia was very pleased with the scarf, but it provided another opportunity for interrogation. "Did Rosie help you choose this?" "Rosie, Rosie, Rosie." "The sales assistant recommended it. It was very straightforward." As I left, Claudia said, "So, Don,
Are you planning to see Rosie again?
Next Saturday, I said, truthfully, not bothering to tell her that it was not a social occasion. We had scheduled the afternoon to analyze the DNA. She seemed satisfied. I was eating lunch alone in the university club, reviewing the father project file, when Jean arrived with his meal and a glass of wine and sat opposite me. I tried to put the file away, but succeeded only in giving him the correct impression that I was trying to hide something. Jean suddenly looked over at the service counter behind me.
"Oh, God," he said.
I turned to look, and Jean snatched the folder, laughing. "That's private," I said, but Jean had opened it. The photo of the graduating class was on top. Jean seemed genuinely surprised.
"My God, where'd you get this?"
He was studying the photo intently.
"It must be 30 years old. What's all the scribble?"
"Organizing a reunion," I said, "helping a friend weeks ago." It was a good answer, considering the short time I had to formulate it, but it did have a major defect. Jean detected it.
"A friend? Right. One of your many friends. You should have invited me."
"Why?"
"Who do you think took the photo?"
Of course. Someone had been required to take the photo. I was too stunned to speak.
"I was the only outsider," said Jean. "The genetics tutor. Big night. Everyone pumped, no partners. Hottest ticket in town."
Jean pointed to a face in the photo. I'd always focused on the males and never looked for Rosie's mother. But now that Jean was pointing to her, she was easy to identify. The resemblance was obvious, including the red hair, although the color was less dramatic than Rosie's. She was standing between Isaac Esler and Jeffrey Case. As in Isaac Esler's wedding photo, Case was smiling broadly.
"Bernadette O'Connor." Jean sipped his wine. "Irish."
I was familiar with the tone of Jean's statement. There was a reason for him remembering this particular woman, and it was not because she was Rosie's mother. In fact, it seemed that he didn't know the connection, and I made a quick decision not to inform him. His finger moved one space to the left.
"Jeffrey Case. Not a great return on his tuition fees."
"He died, correct? Killed himself." This was new information. "Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure," said Jean. "Come on, what's this about?"
I ignored the question. Why did he do it?
"Probably forgot to take his lithium," said Jean. "He had bipolar disorder, life of the party on a good day."
He looked at me. I assumed he was about to interrogate me as to the reason for my interest in Jeffrey Case and the reunion, and I was thinking frantically to invent a plausible explanation. I was saved by an empty pepper grinder. Jean gave it a twist, then walked away to exchange it. I used a table napkin to swab his wine glass and left before he returned. Chapter 29. I cycled to the university on Saturday morning with an unidentifiable and therefore disconcerting emotion. Things were settling back into their normal pattern. The day's testing would mark the end of the father project. At worst, Rosie might find a person that we had overlooked. Another tutor or caterer or perhaps someone who had left the party early. But a single additional test would not take long, and I would have no reason to see Rosie again. We met at the lab. There were three samples to test. The swab from Isaac Esler's fork, a urine sample on toilet paper from Freiburg's floor, and Jean's table napkin. I'd still not told Rosie about the handkerchief from Margaret Case, but was anxious to get a result on Jean's sample. There was a strong possibility that Jean was Rosie's father. I tried not to think about it, but it was consistent with Jean's reaction to the photo, his identification of Rosie's mother, and his history of casual sex.
"What's the napkin?" asked Rosie.
I was expecting this question.
"Retest. One of the earlier samples was contaminated."
My improving ability at deception was not enough to fool Rosie.
"Bullshit. Who is it?"
"Case, isn't it? You got a sample for Jeffrey Case."
It would have been easy to say yes, but identifying the sample as Case's would create great confusion if it tested positive. A web of lies.
"I'll tell you if it's the one," I said.
Tell me now, said Rosie. It is the one. How can you know?
I just know.
You have zero evidence. Isaac Esler's story makes him an excellent candidate. He was committed to getting married to someone else right after the party.